here. So my interview with Lily is on the my YouTube channel. So you can just search Gail Kimble YouTube, and there's lots of interesting interviews there. Lily is from Brazil. She had a really interesting journey growing up in poor areas near the favelas, the slums in Brazil, came to the U.S., had a period of time without a home, pulled herself up by her bootstraps, and now she's working on a program called Seeds of Love, and she's raising money to build a botanical garden and a school. She coordinates volunteers, so you can look up Seeds of Love online and look for the interview on my YouTube channel. So let me thank our supporters. Ask Dr. Gail is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your state local partner to the California Arts Council since 2001. Friends of the Arts creates economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and by publishing a bi-monthly arts and culture newsletter. To stay in the know or have your event listed, visit friendsof.art. Ask Dr. Gail is also made possible by Drunken Dumpling in Chico. It serves locally sourced, fresh, handmade Asian fusion comfort food at 1414 Park Avenue, Suite 120, just behind Nobby's. Open 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. Tuesday through Thursday, and from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Friday and Saturday. Details on Facebook, Instagram, and at drunkendumplingchico.com. Drunken Dumpling is where they love food, flavor, and our community. Ask Dr. Gail is also made possible by the generous contributions of you, KZFR supporters, and by D.A. Lampe Construction, a proud supporter of KZFR and Community Radio in Northern California. For more information, visit dalampeconstruction.com. Ask Dr. Gail is also made possible by Mountain Sports, for over 45 years providing outdoor clothing and equipment for hiking, backpacking, camping, traveling, and enjoying the great outdoors. Mountain Sports is open Monday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. and 11 to 4 on Sunday at 176 East 3rd Street in downtown Chico. And then I wanted to make sure you know about Shalom Free Clinic, where I do volunteer work. They're open every Sunday afternoon at 1010 Mangrove behind Western Dental. And there's no money, no insurance, nothing monetary that changes hands. And every Wednesday, we do chakra balancing and Reiki from 5 to 7 p.m. drop-in, again at 1010 Mangrove. And there's two Liz's who do Reiki, and I'm a Reiki master, and we're happy to do a Reiki 1 class if anybody is interested in becoming a Reiki practitioner. It's universal life force energy, a Japanese word, and you're attuned so that the energy can flow through you and do healing work. So what I'm going to do is play a show on climate connection. But before we do that, let's do a visualization to achieve your goals. Those of you who know me know that I think thought is really powerful. And an example of that is, proof of that is, someone with multiple personalities called dissociative identity disorder. One personality could wear glasses, the other not need them. One personality could have diabetes, the other not. To me, just that one fact alone, that a different personality can have a totally different body, you know, reaction, health profile, indicates the power of thought. Another proof is placebo. It confounds pharmaceuticals companies in their testing a lot, because often the placebo, the sugar pill, is as effective 40% of the time as the chemical, the pharmaceutical. And this is not woo-woo. A professor at Harvard, Ted Kapachuk, is doing research on placebo. And what he found is, even if I know this is placebo, if the doctor says this is a sugar pill, but it's had good effects on other people, then it can be effective. And he also found that it can be more effective. It's a big red pill, say, rather than a little white pill or whatever. I'm going to sneeze. Excuse me. Hay fever. I need Reiki. So we're going to do a visualization to achieve your goals. So if you would, pick a goal. Could be anything, but let's have it be a short-term outcome so you can see how this works. And imagine that you have a balloon in front of you, and you could think about what color it is, and then write your goal in the balloon. So a fun thing I've done in Energy Tools workshops is a goal of unexpected money from a good source. And one woman got $40,000 from an insurance settlement that she didn't know anything about. One woman found a $50 bill. I found $90 in a nylon package that I got at a thrift store. And it's pretty amazing what clear intent can do. So think of writing your goal in the balloon. See the letters, see the words. And then put in the feeling of, yes, this is great. I'm going to achieve my goal. My goal is in the works right now. And then put a grounding cord, like you would have a cord on a balloon deep in the earth, and set the intention, because studies show that intention is the key to harnessing the power of thought. Set the intention to release anything from the balloon that stands in the way of achieving your goal. And then see how you do this. Do you see it? Do you hear it? Do you feel it? Do you know it? Fill your balloon 100% with amusement. No little air pockets. Total amusement, because amusement creates flow. It keeps you in the current of our guidance, whereas rigid, trying hard, tenseness blocks information receptivity. So 100% amusement. And then fill it 100% with enthusiasm. Yes, I'm achieving this goal as we speak. And then imagine your fairy godmother drives up in her coach. She takes out her wand and she sprinkles your balloon 100% with gold miracle dust. So this is like energizing the goal, 100% full of gold sparkles. And then she goes, kiss, kiss, darling, I love to help you achieve your goals. Call on me anytime. And then she goes off to achieve her goal, help someone else achieve their goals. And then drop the cord on the balloon with your intention. Visualize the balloon changing into a helium balloon. It goes off into the etheric plane to hook up your goal with the actualization of that goal. And then the last step is important. And that is, you visualize, or see, however you want to get the impression of a gauge, like a thermometer or a thermometer, from 1 to 100. And I'm going to ask you a question. And the question is, how much permission do you give yourself to achieve your goal in the near future? And then if you're not at 100, then today you move it up 10%. And then tomorrow, 10%, until you're at 100. And what I do, which you may have a better technique than I do, is I imagine scrubbing the gauge up 10 like I would scrub a burnt rice cooking pan. And that's all there is to it. And this and other techniques for using the power of thought and healing and clairvoyance are in my book, Essential Energy Tools, How to Develop Your Clairvoyant and Healing Abilities. Okay, I welcome you to email me at gkimble@csuchico.edu with suggestions for topics, and come in on a Wednesday and get an energy balance. And now we'll hear Climate Connection and see what they have to say.
And this is Climate Connections. Battling wildfires is dangerous and exhausting work, but some firefighters are getting support from a team of four-legged friends. Heidi Carmen is founder of First Responder Therapy Dogs, which is based in California. Her group brings certified crisis response therapy dogs to wildfire base camps and fire stations so firefighters can spend time with the dogs.
They don't even have to say any words, but there's just this magic that happens between a firefighter and the therapy dog.
Firefighters often see homes go up in smoke. They may see their colleagues injured or even killed. They work grueling hours and can be away from home for months. So they face high rates of anxiety, PTSD, depression, and even suicide. And the risks are increasing as climate change causes more extreme fires.
I am definitely seeing the stress on the firefighters, especially the last couple of years. They're overworked, exhausted.
Carmen hopes spending time with a therapy dog helps relieve their stress and reduces the stigma around mental health.
My goal is to just help them feel better and maybe even help them feel okay to ask for help if they need it.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Increasingly, these decisions and these huge, huge debates for our future are being held in state capitals, and people aren't still paying enough attention to the people who are making those decisions, how they got there, who they're beholden to, what their point of views are, and the fact that a sad number of them are simply not telling the truth about key things that are happening in this country.
There are forces in the U.S. that like to selectively bring up states' rights from time to time. With the impending decision stripping the federal protections for access to safe abortion, this is one of those times. But most of us don't methodically monitor what happens in states that are not our own. Wouldn't it be nice if there were a single source where one could find reliable reporting on state-level politics and policies? This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to the founder and publisher of the state's newsroom, Chris Fitzsimon. We discuss the business model for this nonprofit news outlet, the landscape of the online news industry, and why it's more vital than ever to deliver readers truthful, well-presented local news. Then we revisit part of last year's discussion with Liz King, the Director of Education at the Leadership Council on Civil and Human Rights, as she outlines the battle over civil rights in our nation's public schools. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Chris Fitzsimon. He is the founder and publisher of the state's newsroom. Chris, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I bet a lot of our listeners have read pieces that have gone through the state's newsroom network, but haven't even been aware of it. Why don't you explain your organization's model and why you decided there was a need for what you do?
Well, I think we are founded on a fairly simple principle, and that is that the level of government that is has the most effect on people's lives and is covered the less, if you combine those two things, is state government. A lot of people always want to, and I do too, I'm very interested in what's happening in Congress and the White House and the Supreme Court, especially recently. But for the most part, most Americans' daily lives are impacted more by what happens in their state than any other level of government. And that has been happening while the people, the number of people who cover that has been dramatically shrinking over the last decade as the national media has undergone its contraction. That's a lot of times the first place people cut, the legacy newspapers cut. So we exist to help fill that void and to try to step into capitals where the press corps has shrunk by 50, 60, even 80% over the last decade, and provide some daily reporting and some analysis and enterprise reporting and commentary about what's happening in state capitals. We've been around since 2017. We've been an independent national nonprofit since 2019. We just launched our 26th outlet in Nebraska in January. May 11th, the Alaska Beacon will launch and become the 27th outlet. We have a Washington Bureau. We have a national site. Another big point I want to make is that a lot of decisions that are made in your state capital, wherever you're listening to this today, are not in a vacuum. There are similar bills and issues that come up in every state capital across the country. So we have a national site, newsfromthestates.com, which lets you see all of those in one place. You can search for voting rights, you can search for climate change, and you can see all those stories from capitals around the country, and you'll quickly realize that it's not an accident that they're taking up the same things, often regressive legislation that is a model sent to legislators by various places. And we also have a national newsletter to try to sort of synthesize that for people. So it's all built around giving people more information to make decisions about their lives about a place we think has the most impact, which is state capitals.
And does your relationship with these states' newsrooms, for lack of a better term, within the states' newsroom model, does it vary greatly, or is your relationship similar with all of these organizations? Have some of the papers already existed and they've kind of used you as a distribution outlet, et cetera?
The vast majority are outlets that we started. We visited state capitals, got to know people, talked to advocates and media folks, and then hired well-respected journalists to run them. So we have 23 now of those. We'll soon have 24. We do have three partner outlets, we call them, one of which is NC Policy Watch, where I used to work. One is the Maine Beacon, and one is Maryland Matters. They did previously exist. And that I think that probably will change. Some of those might actually come on board, depending on how everything goes in the next couple of years. But the vast majority of our outlets are ones that we started, and they work for us. They are supervised by national editors. Here, all their digital support and all those things are handled in a central office. The Washington Bureau works for them as well. So it's all, the idea is we try to centralize a lot of the back end things and some of the supervision, so the people in the states can do the journalism and tell their audiences what's important and what the information they need to know, and work with communities to find out what they need to know as well.
So you talk about the journalists in these various states. The 26, 27 states that you mentioned, you're not covering Albany, Sacramento, some of the bigger states in terms of your low-hanging fruit. Is that fair to say?
It is at this point. I'm not sure what the future will hold, but we do have, I mentioned the News from the States site, which we run, that has all of our content constantly fed and has curated stories, but we have just signed an agreement with the Texas Tribune, for example, so their content will be there. So there'll be some other states that we don't run on that particular site. But, right, we don't, we're not in Sacramento, we're not in Austin, we're not in Albany at this point.
And what kind of journalistic standards are you able to apply, or do you want to espouse for your network of sites, Chris?
Well, I think we do the best job we can to cover what's important, and we try to let people in the states tell us what that is, communities in the states and people that have issues and needs and ideas about their lives, and our journalists are very responsive to them. We do have ethic guidelines. We do have we abide by journalism practices. That's a weird phrase, I guess, these days. We don't cover everything the same. We don't treat every side the same. We don't print things that are patently false. Or if we do print something that a politician says that is false, we point out that it's false. I think we're trying to do, as journalism is evolving, we're trying to be part of that evolution and tell people the information they need to know, not merely be stenographers, but be analysts as well, and try to include as many community voices as we can in that process. And we do have commentary, which is, I guess, been described as left of center. I'll leave it to other people to label it, but we try to write about state and local issues. Our editors do, and we have a lot of guest commentaries from members of the community. So interestingly, a lot of legacy papers are shying away now from commentary, and we think it's an important part of the journalism landscape.
I just noticed that the New York Times hired a new editor-in-chief, Joe Kahn, who his first statement was a little troubling in that it kind of talked about how the Times has an obligation to cover both sides, and that is almost a flashpoint term for a lot of people following the media, is both sidesism. You mentioned how you're not going to be allowing your network organizations to be publishing things that are patently false, but it must be a tricky dance when there is so much misinformation out there. What are your thoughts on the Kahn hiring, and how does a publisher decide what is wheat and what is
chaff? If you're just joining in, you're listening to KZFR,
that's the question. I guess Kahn hiring, I also maybe took a pause when I read that. But we'll have to see how that plays out into the news pages of the New York Times. You know, the irony, of course, is that the New York Times is assailed all the time as being on one side by the conservatives.
Starting
at the same time,
seeds
a lot of
love
us are worried that they do
raise
cover
money,
both sides, not as critically as they should. The dilemma, I think, for journalists is it is news when a politician who's elected to represent tens of thousands in the state or hundreds of thousands of people in the state says things that are patently false. That's a news story
YouTube,
that someone who is representing people is saying things that are simply not true.
She's also on the board,
but the obligation is to point out that it's not true and to put those things in context so people have information. We can't ignore the fact that we have elected officials who are lying about, well, the last election is the most obvious example. So we have to cover that and try to explain it. And I think
sports,
that we're increasingly, as I mentioned in the very first answer to the very first question, increasingly these decisions and huge debates for our future are being held in state capitals, and people aren't still paying enough attention to the people who are making those decisions, how they got there, who they're beholden to, what their point of views are, and the fact that a sad number of them are simply not telling the truth about key things that are happening in this country.
Top hat of the peanut man, talking about your pot of gold, the silver liner. Tumbling dice, hit it twice, boats and the flushes, they sure look nice on my pot of gold, the silver liner. Stayed alive, give you hard times, stayed too long. Goodbye, pretty women, I ain't staying on. Come on, get a hunch, better a bunch. Come to gamble, better pack at lunch. Pot of gold, silver lining.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Chris Fitzsimon. He is the founder and publisher of The States Newsroom. So, Chris, you mentioned how you started The States Newsroom in 2017, and it became a nonprofit 2 years later. Why don't you expand, if you can, on the challenges of being a nonprofit news organization and maybe some of the benefits as well?
Yeah, well, the challenges, of course, is that we don't have access to the resources, obviously, that a legacy media outlet would have. But I think there's no question that nonprofits and philanthropy and is going to play a significant role in journalism going forward. One of the things that is freeing for a lot of our journalists and editors is that we don't judge the success of a story by the number of clicks. We want people to read the stories. We don't do stories simply to get readers. We monitor our audience, and we want to, but if there's a really important story, we do it. And if a lot of people don't read it, we feel like we have to figure out other ways to get it in front of people and promote it and share it and try to create a buzz around it because we think it's important. So I think the advantage is we're not beholden to turning a profit at the end of the day. And the biggest advantage, I think by far, is that we make our coverage and our content free to everyone. We have a republishing tool that's very easy that we developed, our digital team developed. And in an average month, we'll probably have 4,000 to 5,000 stories reprinted across the country in small papers that have no way to afford coverage. They can't afford Associated Press. They can't send someone to the Capitol, certainly a reporter. So a small town in Iowa now, I always think of that, I use that paper as an example, has state coverage for the first time in 10 years probably because they carry our coverage about what's happening in Des Moines. But interestingly, the Des Moines Register also runs our stories because their workforce has been slashed so much that they can't cover the news either. We're just trying to fill that void as best we can. But I think the biggest advantage of a nonprofit is we not only are allowed, we allow people to publish. We have an obligation to allow people, I think, because we're a public good now as a nonprofit, and we try to serve the community that way.
Maybe you can recap, because I'm not really as familiar as I imagine you are, of some of the efforts on the for-profit news side of things over the last couple decades to take advantage of a fragmented industry that's kind of been kind of regrouping as the age of the internet and consumers expect to read everything for free, that new reality. I'm thinking of, like, I know Sheldon Adelson's group has bought up a lot of small papers. How have those efforts not only worked from a business standpoint, but affected journalism on a state's level in general?
Yeah, well, in general, there are waves of layoffs still happening in the journalism industry in the legacy media outlets. There are waves of layoffs, and there are takeover bids, and there are legacy newspapers, wonderful newspapers with wonderful histories, or storied histories, I should say, who are now owned by a hedge fund whose goal is to maximize profit, is to shrink the workforce, is to reduce the number of people who actually do the journalism. And sort of benefit as much as they can off the brand and then, you know, move in another direction. So it's very alarming. And I have lots of friends that's still at legacy newspapers. And it's a constant struggle and battle for them to do their jobs. I still encourage people to subscribe to those papers, to do the best they can to support them. But it is very difficult for a lot of journalists around the country. And, you know, we have people who in states that we're not in who will write us and say, are you coming to our state? Because we don't have enough people covering it. We want to work at a place that that we can feel good about and secure in. I always tell people, I don't know what the future of journalism is. We might all be receiving news in our head, in a chip in our forehead in 20 years. But I know that as we get to that place, we can't wait for the perfect model, and philanthropy and public support of nonprofit journalism has to play and will continue to play a key role, I think, in trying to keep democracy alive, which we used to take for granted. I'm not so sure we can anymore.
And are all of your publications digital only, or are there some in print?
They are digital. They are digital only. I'm not sure what the future will hold there, but they are at this point all digital.
And maybe you can kind of give us a glimpse into what your headcount is and your budget and your funding plans, and maybe if you're allowed to kind of give us an idea of where the bulk of your funding comes from, Chris.
Yeah, well, when we were trying to decide what we should do about talking about our funding, we looked at that there's a group called Chalkbeat, which is a national education organization. And some people like them, some people don't. I think they have really good reporters there. They're in a series of states. So we sort of established their model. And everybody that's given us $500 or more is listed on our website. So they're big donors, small donors, and everybody in between. So we get foundation support. We get a lot of reader support. And what we try to do is go to a state with enough to pay for a small staff. And then in almost every state, we've received enough support to increase our reach with additional staff people or additional freelancers. Every state that we start has an editor and three reporters. So we have four full-time journalists, which doesn't sound like much, but in some states, it makes us one of the larger folks at the state capitol. And all those, unlike a lot of nonprofits, and again, I applaud, we work across the country with a lot of folks in partnerships, but those journalists don't have to do much except report and edit and write and speak and get to know people and get to know the community, because we have almost all their support is done by folks either here in North Carolina or in Washington. So that the model really is we want the people in the states to do the journalism.
So do you have a big enough footprint to be able to set aside environmental reporting as a subset and climate change as a main focus? Why don't you kind of give us an idea of where you're hoping to delve into the green side of journalism?
Yeah, thank you for the question. We certainly cover the environment in every state because climate change and environmental issues are so important to our future, but also the quality of life that we have now. We have one of the best environmental reporters in the country at North Carolina Policy Watch, who I think has won virtually every award you can win, Lisa Sorg. We have dedicated environmental reporters in several states. We have one in Virginia that's funded by the Oak Hill Foundation in Virginia. We have other contributors in various states. We would love to expand and have full-time climate or environmental reporters in all of our outlets. And some we're able to and some we're not. So that is definitely something we would love to do in the future. And a lot of people, that give us money, and we have, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of individuals who give us money, mention climate and the environment often. So we're constantly trying to figure out how we're going to expand that. We're working on, and I think you'll see more regional projects from our states that have things in common, whether it's in the Southwest or the Northeast. We've been working with we may have an environmental project with some nonprofits in Louisiana. So we're constantly trying to do what we can to give people the information they need.
And how do people know that they're on a state's newsroom site, and maybe give them some calls to action when they come across your content and they're impressed enough to want to become regular readers?
Yeah, well, there every news, first of all, every outlet, if you go to the New Hampshire Bulletin, if you just click about the New Hampshire, if you want to find out, if you think this is a good website, you go to the New Hampshire Bulletin, it'll tell you that you're on that New Hampshire Bulletin is part of the state's newsroom network. Every outlet has its own daily newsletter that's delivered in the morning, as does News from the States, our national site. You can sign up the newsletters are all free. Every newsletter also has a place, and every website has a place where you can donate, even if it's, $10 or $100 or whatever you're able to give. That would be great. We do count on reader support for expanding our coverage and making sure we continue to cover the things that people need to know in each state capital and across the country.
The organization is the State's Newsroom. He's the publisher and founder, Chris Fitzsimon. Chris, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
For you, baby, things ain't like they used to be. I've got news for you, baby, things ain't like they used to be. I'm cutting out on you, darling, going back to my old time used to be. Now I thought I was your lover, but I was just your little fool. I thought I was your lover, but I'm just your little fool. And you taught me a lot of things that I never learned in school.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Liz King. Liz is the Senior Director of the Education Equity Program at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Liz, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate the opportunity to engage.
So you want to double the budget for the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights. What does that mean logistically? What is like the current budget, and what would doubling it mean, not only in terms of a dollar number, but in terms of just looking at all the complexities from a political standpoint?
Sure. So thinking about both the technical aspect of federal funding and then going to the political implications, last year, the Office for Civil Rights received $131 million President Biden has requested that that be increased to $144 million, which is important. You know, we appreciate that President Biden has recognized that additional funding for civil rights enforcement is an important part of any agenda that describes itself as supporting racial equity or LGBTQ equity or gender justice. We are asking for $260 million for the Office for Civil Rights, given the context of the COVID-19 public health crisis and its serious detrimental effects on educational equity, given the DeVos agenda of discrimination and exclusion we've seen for the last 4 years, and given, frankly, the significant challenges too many students were facing even before the Trump inauguration to accessing an equal educational opportunity. We think that now is the time, in the context of a long overdue racial reckoning, in the context of very clear demands from students and their families that we attend to the ways in which they experience discrimination and marginalization, now is the time to robustly invest in the critical functions of the Office for Civil Rights, in the everyday experience of students, and the way in which every student deserves an opportunity to submit a complaint of discrimination when they experience discrimination in their school, and have the Office for Civil Rights ready to respond, to provide them support in the context of that complaint, to intervene when there is discrimination. And most importantly, the Office for Civil Rights needs the resources to prevent discrimination in the first place, to provide technical assistance to schools, school districts, to educators who reach out and ask for advice and guidance about how to provide an education free from discrimination. We need data. We need the civil rights data collection and the data it provides about every public school in the United States and the educational opportunity being provided to those students. So these critical functions of the Office for Civil Rights play an incredibly important role in educational opportunity for students, which we know is determinative of the future of our country. And now is the time to meaningfully invest and ensure the Office for Civil Rights has the resources that it needs.
Liz, maybe you can put into context what it means for children of color to be put out of school in the kind of rates that we've seen across the country, and how that ends up feeding other concerns all through society, namely the school-to-prison pipeline.
In this country, we have a deeply discriminatory system of school discipline that is resulting in the exclusion and criminalization of Black children, Native American children, other children of color, children with disabilities, and in many instances, most especially children of color with disabilities. LGBTQ students are finding themselves disproportionately excluded from school as a result of discipline policies and practices. Thankfully, the Office for Civil Rights in the Obama administration finally took meaningful action to make plain and clear that racial discrimination in the context of school discipline was unlawful under our civil rights laws. But we know this is not just an esoteric concept around compliance with a law or data collection. We know this has a real effect in the everyday experience of children. We have all been reminded in the COVID-19 crisis what the real consequences are when a child misses a day of school or more. We see children being pushed out of school on the basis of school discipline for days and weeks and months at a time. We cannot afford for children to lose even a single hour of instruction, let alone the implications of a racially disproportionate and an unjust, ableist system of school discipline. Educators want and deserve support to provide an education free from discrimination, and that includes in the context of school discipline. Thankfully, there has been amazing leadership by youth in this country to demand that their schools become safe, welcoming, and inclusive places for them to learn, grow, and thrive. We have seen in the past the Office for Civil Rights show leadership and demonstrate its responsibility to ensure that our laws are being followed and that children have access to an education free from discrimination. When a child is suspended out of school, it can have significant consequences for them. It can have academic consequences when they lose instruction. There can be risks to their safety and well-being if there is not a safe place for them to be when they're not in school. And we know definitively from repeated research, what common sense would tell us, which is that suspending or expelling a child puts them on a very dangerous trajectory to a very difficult life circumstance. We have a responsibility to ensure that all schools are safe, welcoming, and inclusive for all children. The Office for Civil Rights has a specific responsibility in that, as does every child and parent and educator in this country. We need to make sure the Office for Civil Rights has the resources it needs so that every child can attend school free from discrimination, including in the context of school discipline.
She's the Senior Director of the Education Equity Program at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, Liz King. Liz, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to SeaChange Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Fog Swamp, Stephen Stills, and T-Bone Walker. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.
Why don't we begin?
Hey, and welcome to Fresh Hop Cinema, a craft beer and movie show based in Chico, California. I am Max Minardi. I'm Johnny Summers. Welcome back. This week on the show, our thoughts on Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. It's the latest MCU film starring Benedict Cumberbatch as Dr. Stephen Strange, who, after a terrible nightmare, meets a young kid with multiversal dimensional traveling powers being hunted by big scary creatures. And it's up to Strange and his clan of magic monks to protect this child so her powers don't fall into the wrong hands. The film's directed by superhero directing veteran Sam Raimi. Raimi, of course, the man behind the early 2000s Spider-Man 1, 2, and 3. Johnny, you and I are both fans of that original trilogy due to, in part, the direction of Sam Raimi. Hopefully some of that creativity will shine through the thick fog of MCU corporate demands, but we'll get to that later.
Yeah, we will, because you saying that I'm a fan of Spider-Man 3 in any capacity.
It was just the intro. Like, I didn't want to mess it up. Like, obviously 1 and 2 were better.
A little presumptuous.
Sure, fair
just
enough.
Saying. All right, this week on the show, we've got beers from Logston Farmhouse Ales out of Washougal, Washington. The first is called Intergalactic Cemetery. It's a sour ale, clocking at 4%. Nice little session guy for our first beer. The second is a beer called Forager. It is an imperial porter aged in whiskey barrels with candy cap mushrooms, which we will tell you all about once we get to that beer in the second part of our show.
That's right. If you're listening on KZFR 90.1 FM, we hope you're having just the most fantastic Thursday evening ever. I do hate to make it worse by telling you that unfortunately you won't be hearing our episode today in its entirety. You're only going to get the first beer review and the spoiler-free portion of our discussion of Doctor Strange.
Yeah, Max. But if they want to hear the full conversation, which includes spoilers for Doctor Strange in the Danger Zone, a review of that second beer with the mushrooms in it, and Hot and Bothered, where would they go?
Fair question. Our podcast is basically everywhere. Spotify, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, etc. Or you can just go to our website, freshhopcinema.com. We drop new episodes every Friday morning at 7 a.m. If you like the show, feel free to leave us a 5-star rating and or a review, particularly on Apple Podcasts, and let us know that you did. For all your social media needs, find the show on Letterboxd for film reviews and Untapped for beer reviews at Fresh Hop Cinema, or like I said, check out our website, www.freshhopcinema.com. Okay, housekeeping out of the way, sir. We're getting into beers. You got these this week, and tell me a little bit about maybe where you got both of them and what the brewery is. Remind people, please.
Yeah, so both beers again this week are going to be from Logston Farmhouse Ales out of Washougal, Washington. They are a brewery that's been around for a really long time. I'm familiar with their stuff probably for the last, I don't know, as long as I've been in the beer industry, they've sure. been around, notorious for really solid bottles of barrel-aged farmhouse ales, things mm-hmm. like that. They've just recently got into canning, kind of just starting to stay with the trends, so loving to see some smaller quantities, a more approachable package size with these guys. Really excited to dig into them. First time they've ever been on the show. So
great.
Let's dig into it. The first one is called Intergalactic Cemetery. It is a sour ale that's only 4%, and we got both of our beers this week at S&S Produce.
Nice.
Friends of the show, fantastic beer selection. Check them out.
Yeah.
This beer features Galaxy and Citra dry hopping using a...
Give it a go.
Lacanque?
I would say Lachance.
Lachance.
Yeast.
Yeast. The yeast... Wild Brew Philly Sour was found in a cemetery in Philadelphia and produces lactic acid and ethanol.
That's so cool.
So we're going to have a huge lemony tropical fruit flavor with medium and soft acidity. And it says that it is eminently drinkable. There's some really cool writing on the can and I have to read it.
Yeah, please, by all means. So I've just poured mine too. I always lock up a little bit at breweries that pride themselves on farmhouse ales because I usually have a bit of an averse taste reaction to some of the funkier notes that are present in traditional farmhouse ales. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to know what this is going to be like, but you're looking at the can now. What you got?
All right. So I got a whole paragraph here. So I want a full 3-page essay on this beer when I get back. Here we go.
Sure.
In a graveyard in Philadelphia in 2017, a group of University of the Sciences students made an amazing discovery. From a collected sample of the bark of a dogwood tree, a previously unknown beer fermenting species of yeast was found that produces lactic acid during its fermentation process, creating a beer with moderate tartness and citrus and stone fruit flavors and aromas. This beer may taste like a mixed cultured sour beer, but there is no bacteria or Brettanomyces used. All of the fermentation character is solely from this unique pure culture yeast. We brewed a sessionable table saison style wort with malted barley, wheat, and flaked oats in order to highlight the unique yeast character. It was then dry hopped with Galaxy and Citra to further accentuate citrus, stone fruit, and tropical aromas for science.
This beer looks like the brewery Lindemans does it. It's almost like, well, I can't think of it, but it almost looks like a goose.
Raspberry frambois.
Yeah, no, not that. But it almost looks like a goose, like a traditional goose. It's a pale straw yellow. Mine's got some little bit of lacing around the top, and it's looking like it's still carbonating a bit. It's fully, fully lemon forward. I don't know about the stone fruit business you were talking about. This is a lemon fresh off the tree. Did you taste it yet?
Yeah. It's lemony. I feel like I'm getting some subtle raspberry notes, but excellent lemon forward. Just pop.
It's really, really refreshing. There's a bitter quality on the back end, but for the most part, it's a really sweet, not quite as sweet as like a Meyer lemon would be, but in no way an artificial kind of candy lemon. It's a straight up lemon flavor. Yeah, with some warmth in there. It's some softness that mm-hmm. I'm really digging as well.
Yeah, it's not abrasive. It's very drinkable. It doesn't have a lot of rough edges. It's really like a smooth throughout. There's no bristly, like super aggressive notes in any way. Like it's a very approachable farmhouse style beer.
Yeah, we should probably at some point. We don't have to at this moment. We should point out the can art.
Obviously.
I've just noticed it.
You know why.
I saw one side of it earlier. Now I see the other side and I see they're interacting, which is a great joke. We'll talk about in a second. But what I was reading on the can is the front that really emphasizes the Galaxy Citra dry hopping. And this beer doesn't strike me as particularly hop forward with the flavors of those hops. Definitely not Galaxy. Maybe Citra. But it doesn't, the bitterness that you would kind of get from those hops, and granted they're dry hopping it, so maybe they're going for more of the sweetness, but it's not really that sweet either. It's very citrusy and bitey, but not sharp, like you said.
I think the hops really added an element of like dryness in the mouthfeel. Mm-hmm. There's like a dry bitterness that isn't aggressive on mm-hmm. the palate, but it really lends itself to the mouthfeel. So you're getting that bitterness in the hops just like with that dry finish, like once it's out of your mouth, the aftertaste, it really does dry your mouth out a little bit.
Yeah, it's not unlike some kind of mimosa would be. I don't know who's making lemon juice mimosas.
Oh, that's an aggressive
And
move.
They wouldn't be as good as this is the thing. They'd be way too bitter. But I think this is what a lemon mimosa might taste like if it was made by the gods or something.
Yeah.
It's very good.
It has all of the notes of a farmhouse that people enjoy. or that maybe don't like this style would enjoy.
Yeah.
And none of the parts of a farmhouse ale that traditionally turn people off. That super aggressive yeast profile.
Yeah.
The smell.
There's no funkiness here.
No. I mean, it is, but it's so understated and it's just like boosted with this stone fruitiness.
Yeah.
I get tons of nectarine on this.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
It's very nice. It's very dry. It's punchy, but subtle. Like it's a really just approachable, very drinkable, 4%.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. 4%.
Get out.
Which is nice. I think, yeah. I mean, we've been doing a lot of higher ABV beers on the show recently, and not that we aren't later. We're doing 10.7% beer in the second half of the show, but, with summer kind of rolling around in Chico, it's nice to have something that isn't maybe just a pilsner.
Yeah.
That has a couple more layers and a little bit different that you can reach for that isn't necessarily going to knock you out. And I think a 4% pretty drinkable lemon forward sour ale is great. There's a, yeah, going off what you were saying about how this is has some things that people, doesn't have the things that people traditionally don't like. Like, yeah, this could have been so sour. Like, we're not really talking about the sour.
Yeah.
The traditional, telltale signs of a sour, like the lymph node crunch and stuff. Like, this is very, very mellow, but also really sharp too.
Exactly. It has just enough acidity, but it is not like sour. I wouldn't call this a sour.
I would call it a sour. I would agree with you. It does not taste sour. It tastes it. Well, I would say it doesn't taste overwhelmingly sour. There's certainly sour qualities. Like the lemon is unavoidable for me.
Yeah.
It's a well-balanced, not overwhelming sour.
Super approachable.
Yeah, yeah, dude.
Fantastic. Great river beer.
I knew you were going to say that.
Really good gateway to farmhouse beers and sour beers if you have someone in your life that doesn't traditionally enjoy them too.
Yeah. I really wish I knew more about the process of making beers in a situation like this, because I think what they've done here by avoiding the use of any traditional like Brettanomyces, like they said, this is a straightforward beer that tastes like one that isn't. It tastes like almost like a wild ale of some kind.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating. I'm sure if I knew more about the production of it and the science, like I would appreciate it even more.
Yeah. Well, because this was a yeast strain.
Yeah.
Nah, I don't even want to venture to see.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Right.
Like,
right.
Because I know like the bacteria that's alive.
You're doing it. Great. Go.
That's alive.
Okay.
Right?
Sure.
Like I just want like let's talk about this like the idiots we are.
Okay, fine.
So like the bacteria, the lactobacillus, the Brettanomyces.
Very much alive.
That's alive.
Sure.
So like that'll keep going. That's why like if you have a really old bottle, sometimes you pop the cork and it like explodes.
Super carbonated. Yeah, it's active the whole time.
Yeah. So
yep.
So a bacteria versus a yeast.
Different. They're different things.
Different because
somehow
yeast eats sugar to create alcohol.
Correct.
And bacteria is like its own thing.
Maybe.
Maybe. So objectively and idiotically speaking, those bacteria, there's no way to like turn those off and they can just be as sour and as wild as they want. Whereas like a yeast, like once there's sugars left to consume, it stops fermenting, perhaps?
Yes. And scene. Everybody, that's a conversation we would have if we didn't know. Obviously, we do, but we're hoping that Logsdon writes into us with the proper answers for how they did this beer.
Or any one of our many friends that actually make beer.
That's true. Of course, everybody, we do know what we're talking about.
Obviously.
Definitely. But we're just playing devil's advocate. Moving on.
This is a fantastic beer. I think it is super approachable, crushable. It's delightful. There's not much I don't like about this. It's going to rate pretty high. This is an 8.5 for me.
Very good rating. 8.5. It's really good. That was my second sip that made my mouth water. Not my second sip, but my second sip since I asked you. I actually took two. I cheated. Man, I mean, I dig it a lot. Your 8.5 is, it kind of throws my brain for a loop because it makes me want to pick one or the other between 8 or 9. And I'm not quite positive that it's a 9 for me. But I'm going to say 8. This is super, super solid. I'm very much about this beer.
Excellent. Well, that's an 8.5 for me and an 8 for Max. That is Intergalactic Cemetery from Logsdon Farmhouse Ales.
That's right. Once again, you're listening to Fresh Hop Cinema, possibly on a Thursday evening on KZFR 90.1 FM. If you get the chance to try Intergalactic Cemetery from Logsdon,
look for the Beer of the Week sticker at SNS Produce.
Nicely done. We do want to know what you think, so please don't hesitate to reach out. And while you're at it, you can take a picture on your Instagram if you want. You can tag us. Hopefully by the time this episode releases, our Instagram is back up. We've had some technical issues. But if it's not, you can send us an email of that picture. You can send it to fhccast@gmail.com. Or if you're enjoying the show, again, please leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Incoming is a trailer for our movie of the week, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, with no spoilers in the next segment. So don't worry, your pretty little heads. We'll be right back.
Every night, I dream the same dream. Nightmare begins. I did what I had to do to protect our world.
You cannot control everything, Strange. You opened the doorway between universes, and we don't know who or what will walk through it.
Wanda, what do you know about the multiverse?
Viz had his theories. He believed it was dangerous.
He was right. I'm sorry, Stephen. Your desecration of reality will not go unpunished.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Fresh Hop Cinema, a show about the worlds of alcohol and film.
Possibly craft beer.
Possibly on KZFR 90.1 FM. Subscribe to Fresh Hop Cinema on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts to hear this discussion in its entirety. It's going to be available to pour into your ear holes tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. So at the end of this, if you just can't get enough, there's plenty more to digest. And what you just heard was a trailer for Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness.
Quote, Dr. Stephen Strange casts a forbidden spell that opens a portal to the multiverse. However, a threat emerges that may be too big for his team to handle. Unquote. What a boring synopsis the internet had. Which is not to say the movie's not boring. There are parts of this movie that are boring, and I want to talk about my thoughts on this. But before we get into our thoughts on Dr. Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, Johnny Summers, I will tell you a couple things you already know. One, this was directed by Sam Raimi. Two, and this is one you don't know, this was written by Michael Waldron. It stars Benedict Cumberbatch, as I mentioned, as Dr. Stephen Strange, a longtime figurehead in the MCU. Elizabeth Olsen shows up as Wanda Maximoff slash the Scarlet Witch, much more Scarlet Witch in this than Wanda. You also have Chiwetel Ejiofor as Carl Mordo. He is from the previous Doctor Strange film. He is, was a buddy of Strange's, but they became enemies. There's a lot of backstory to MCU stuff you have to know going into this that we might talk about. You also have Benedict Wong showing up again as Wong. He is now the Sorcerer Supreme in the aftermath of the events of Avengers Endgame. You also have Xochitl Gomez playing America Chavez. She is the aforementioned teenager who can travel between multiversal dimensions, not quite at will, but with a power that she is learning to control. And then Rachel McAdams shows up again as Christine Palmer, Stephen Strange's longtime female interest and coworker and other personalities as we get into the multiverse here. Cinematography shout out here to John Mathiason with music by Danny Elfman. This film came to theaters on May 6th in wide release and runs 2 hours and 6 minutes long. Johnny, before we get into this, your thoughts on Doctor Strange, the first film?
Hmm.
You a fan? You a fan of the character?
Yes. Okay. Benedict Cumberbatch as Doctor Strange is immediately identifiable. If you are familiar with the comic books, he embodies the persona mm-hmm. of Doctor Strange to a T. I think the casting was excellent, and I am a fan of him as that character. That being said, gun to my head, I could not tell you any of the specifics of the first Doctor Strange.
Dormammu, I've come to bargain. You remember that at the very end?
Vaguely.
Okay.
Like, it's so vague.
It actually is very similar to the description I read from the internet. Is it he casts a bad spell and then there's a portal and then bad guys happen?
I'm just getting the impression that Stephen Strange is not the best wizard. That's really what I'm getting from these descriptions here. Like,
yeah,
come on, man. Cast better spells.
Yeah. He also did the same thing in that Spider-Man movie. He like started this whole multiverse thing.
Yeah.
But okay, fair enough.
So, Doctor Strange's flaws aside, I really
the first movie, not that memorable.
Okay.
It's not standing out.
My second question then is your thoughts on Sam Raimi as a director. I mentioned the Spider-Man movies, which I know that you like 1 and 2. 3 has its issues.
Yeah.
But it also has Tobey Maguire, who you and I both like.
Who has his issues.
Sure. But Sam Raimi has not only done those movies, he's done some other movies that you've seen that I have not.
Yeah, he's done one of my favorite movies of all time,
right,
which is The Evil Dead 2.
Sure.
So you're a fan. Which is just a higher budget remake of The Evil Dead. This is a deep horror film nerd conversation.
Great.
The Evil Dead was done on a shoestring budget. It was essentially a college film, like a senior project
almost. Sam Raimi, though, no?
Also Sam Raimi, but very young, very underfunded Sam Raimi. And Evil Dead 2 really kind of fulfilled his vision and kind of lived up to what he saw in his head. So, yeah. Big fan of Sam Raimi. I've been following his career for some time. He's one of the penultimate horror directors of our time.
Okay, it's fair to say, and I don't think this is spoiling much from this movie, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness takes several horror-ish turns.
Yes.
And I'm curious to know if you think that those were